Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Shout out to all you dunkers. Thank you for once again embracing your bounce. Let's have some fun today.
Let's have some fun today, indeed. And we have a guest, a first in Dunker Spot history. We have an active player on the podcast tonight. So this is fun. We have Los Angeles Sparks guard Brittany Sykes on the pod with us. How are you doing on this manic Monday?
I'm good. I didn't know I said a little history today, so that makes it even better.
We appreciate you rocking with us. Ready to get into some hoops talk. Definitely want to talk about your season so far. But first, I have a very important question for you. As I was doing some prep for the pod, I was checking out some of your prior interviews. You did one with Jordan Liggins for Buckets. And during the rapid fire segment that y'all did together, she asked you if you would rather select bonnets or do-rags. And so you chose do-rags, and then you went on to talk about your extensive collection of do-rags. And then you let it slip that the Sparks told you that you couldn't wear your do-rags at practice. So I just want to know, was this from the league? Was this from the organization? Was this from your head coach that may or may not have the facilities for a do-rag right now? Like, how did that decision get made?
Nah, I think it was just one of those things where it was just a culture. Like, it's you know, nothing. And it wasn't in like a negative way. It was more of those things like, hey, look, we know you could do your work in a do-rag, but for culture purposes, we have new people on the team. We're trying to create this dynamic where, you know, no nonsense, and that a part of that might bring that. So it's like, hey, get rid of the do-rag. I'm like, all right, I can't say nothing to that. They caught me right when I was going into the huddle too. Like, Simone Augustus walked up to me and was like, hey, take this now. I was like, oh, okay. Okay, like, I guess there's no do-rags this year, but I got over it. I just had to make sure my hair was done.
Okay, I got you. You also chose TikTok as one of your answers. What type of TikToks do you watch?
I thought I picked Instagram.
Nah.
Ooh, called out.
I picked Instagram and I said TikTok. I use TikTok to watch videos. Like, but like usage wise, I'm more Instagram than TikTok.
Okay. But
but if I had to pick what I watch, I'd probably say I got like a couple like conspiracy theory things I'd be following up there. A lot of music, anything that involves music, obviously, you know, I'm following it. Funny TikToks, pranks, dancing TikToks, even though I don't have the knee capacity to do them, I enjoy watching them. So that's probably all I probably really watch.
Got you. Well, one, my bad on that for messing up your your answer on that front.
It's all good.
Two, you did mention music. And you also said during this interview that you played, I think, second trumpet at Carnegie Hall. Like, how did that happen?
Man, okay. So I was a freshman in high school, and I had picked up band because you had to take an extracurricular, and it was either choir, band, or I want to say, was it? Did they have? No, we had like computer. You could like learn like computer graphics, or you can learn like how to type of thing. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to just go with, oh, and we had art. And I heard the art teacher was really mean. So I really wasn't trying to get yelled at for learning how to draw. And then I really didn't want to sing. So I'm like, all right, I like instruments. I've been around them all my life. So why not just go to band, pick the trumpet. And just one day my teacher came in, he's like, all right, well, you know, I have a great opportunity where I'm going to start evaluating everybody. Like, there's an opportunity to go to Carnegie Hall. I'm like, I didn't know what Carnegie Hall was. And then I hear it like in a Jay-Z and a Rick Ross song. I'm like, oh, this must be like a really big deal. You know what I mean? So I'm looking up Carnegie Hall, and then I'm like, okay, I really want to make it. So I just keep practicing my trumpet, And then he gave me second trumpet, and I was good with it. I was like, I wanted to be first, and I ended up being first by the end of my freshman year. So this is like mid-pack, and I'm just learning. Like, this is my first year learning, so I end up being first by the end of my freshman year.
That is amazing. Do you still play in your spare time?
No, I've been trying to get a hold of a trumpet, but it's so hard with travel. I feel like once I'm, you know, settled down and everything kind of starts to slow down on the back of my career, I feel like I'll be able to get all those things that I wanted to do now. I'm just too busy trying to build, you know? So it's like, I don't really have time to go do those things right now.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. Let's get into some basketball talk. Then before we get into like the particulars of your season, just a general question that I've always wanted to ask players. When you're not in a game or when you're not practicing, how do you engage with basketball? Are you still just turning on League Pass and watching whatever? Or are you the type to kind of decompress from everything when you're not in it?
I think I have a healthy balance. I think for me, I will very much prioritize my rest overall, because I feel like if you lack rest, then everything else you're trying to do is it's going to lack somewhere else because you don't have that rest that you need. So I try to make sure I get a good amount of sleep. And there are some nights where I do lose sleep because I'm up watching film, I'm looking at stats, like I'm looking at games that are playing, you know, on TV, both NBA and, you know, WNBA, just watching the game, really going back watching old games. Or if I know that we're about to play Vegas, so most likely I'm going to be watching that game about 2-3 times, and each time I'm watching it for something different, you know what I mean? So sometimes I can get a little crazy with it, with how I watch stuff, but for the most part, I think I do a pretty good job of balancing getting my sleep and really, you know, getting into the game off the court.
That was going to be my follow-up question. Did you have to develop that balance as far as being in it? And because you can go left real quick.
I don't went left a couple times. I don't went left a couple times in my career. I think it's just how like growth is continuous. I feel like, you know, in a game, being a pro, there are those cycles that you have to go through to realize like, okay, I'm in this new cycle of my life. What I did in the last cycle might not work for where I'm at right now. So there was times where I would fight the change. And, you know, I think probably this last transition in my career, going from like a fifth to sixth year, everybody makes jokes like, oh man, you did the quickest switch from a rookie to a vet. And anyway, man, you're an old head now. And I guess it's just my mannerisms and everything. But I realized that the things that I were doing my first 5 years, it's not going to work for the next five. So I kind of have to build a new regimen, build a new way to being a pro in my sixth year and like on.
Got you. Were there any veterans in your younger years that kind of took you on the wing like, hey, if you're going to watch film, watch it this way? Or if you're going to watch, maybe watch these kind of parts, look for something like this? Or did you have to kind of sort through that by yourself?
I think it was a mixture of both. And I wouldn't say it was just players. I think it was just people in my camp. I'm a real big believer of like, you are who your camp is, you know? So for me, my high school coach is in my camp, and she, you know, talks to me about basketball. She talks to me about, you know, things that revolve around basketball that have nothing to do with basketball. And so when I talk to her, we have those talks. And then on the outside, I want to say probably like my overseas coach that I just had, he is amazing. And I talk to him about basketball 24/7. So, you know, it's just one of those things where I just talk to the people around me, and it kind of helps me figure out how to go about those things and how to become a pro. And then, yes, I meet my friends throughout the league who have been pros for years, you know, and they talk to me and they show me the ways to how to, you know, all right, come into practice early, make sure you do your bands. Because a lot of rookies make fun of the old heads for using the bands and warming up and doing all the hip exercises. But you don't realize it until you're in year six and you're like, man, I really need those bands. So I learned early. I picked up on it very early. Due to like past injuries in college. So it's like, I was already up there on game, but it's amazing to see like kids now. They're like, what is that? You have no idea.
Are you already starting to take some of the younger guards on the roster under your wing in that regard?
Oh yeah. I think it's one of those things where it's a new role for me to be looked at as, you know, a vet in a sense. And I take that like as an honor, because at one point I was them and I was looking at the older, you know, older heads to guide me. So I take a lot of pride and responsibility in knowing that you know, younger ones are looking at me for guidance in the sense of how to be a pro. Because for me, honestly, I feel like my teaching would have to be like not pertaining to basketball. Like it's about the person. You know what I mean? Like you try to better yourself as a person, being a pro will be easy because you already have like the characteristics and the mannerisms that you need to be a pro because you're already doing it as a person. So that's probably what I'd probably teach him. Or I hope that that's what I'm teaching.
Gotcha. Steve, before I dig in, did you have anything?
Oh, no, I'm flowing. She's dropping gems. I'm here. I was thinking about it. Like you speak about energy and leadership. Like that takes growth as a person to be able to lead others. And then as a pro, as you go from fifth to sixth, is there anything that you've done as far as even just watching the game where you notice I'm seeing this differently? Or I'm viewing this differently, or this is something that maybe I wouldn't have noticed before, but now I know I need to lock in on this.
Yeah. If I had to choose one thing, because it's plenty of things that like I've realized, you know, that how I view the game has changed. For instance, when I said I watched the game at least like two to three times, you know, and I'm like, for instance, if I watch a game back, I'm going to the first time I watch it, I'm watching, okay, how was my defense? And then the second time I'm watching, how was my decision making? What did I miss on offense? What do I need to exploit more on offense? And then on the third one, I'm looking at energy and body. And it's not just me, it's like everybody, but I'm looking at energy and body on both ends because it's like, who on my guarding? I need to look at their energy and body. When this happened, how does their body change? Okay, when this happened, how did my team respond? How did we, you know what I mean? I'm looking at all those things. So in them three times that I'm watching the game, and I might just skip through it because I done watched it twice. So it's like, I know what's coming. So it's like, all right, I don't need to see this part. Boom, I'm fast forwarding. So it's not like I'm sitting there for like 4 or 5 hours. I might sit there for like a solid two and just really just dissect each thing that I need to see. But yeah, it definitely came with a lot of growth and just patience to understanding like everything is a process. Like once I understood that everything was a process and like that was the part that you truly focus on, I was like, oh, all right, I got this. Like you might be doing something here.
Got you. Okay. The primary reason I wanted to have you on the podcast is because you are one of my favorite defenders to watch in the league. And I feel like you're a defender that anyone could appreciate. For the dunkers or some of the nerdier watchers, they'll appreciate how you blow up off ball action. Flying across screen, staying attached, blowing up an offensive action. Now they're late in the clock. They can't do anything. But also, you have the chase down block. I'll entice people. You will have the on-ball steals. Like I was going through some of your film earlier. The way that you anticipate passes from the person that you're guarding is insane to me. And so for people who aren't super familiar with your game, like where does that defensive background come from? Is that an area of your game that's always been strong, or did you have to like shift roles to kind of develop into that type of player? Like, where does that come from?
I think it's always been in me. I just don't think I ever truly tapped into it with as much intention as I have the past 2 years. I'll say that. So when I met, well, past 3 years, because I've been with the Sparks for 3 years now, I always say that I always give credit to our defensive coach, Coach T, LT, Latricia Trammell. When I say like her energy is so infectious, like it made me want to play D because how can you not play defense for somebody who is so passionate? You know, like you almost look crazy not giving as much energy as she's giving you because that's something that you'd want. That's something that you crave as a professional to have somebody that's just as in it as you. And so with her being as infectious as she is with her energy, it just rubbed off on me. So my first year, we in the bubble, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is fun. Like, this leads to offense. And to be honest, I'm on a new team. Like, people don't really realize, it's like, I'm on a new team. I just spent my last 3 years in Atlanta. Now I'm in LA. I'm with Candace Parker, Chelsea Gray, or Quanta Williams. Like, I'm with some heavy hitters, NECA, like, you know what I mean? Like, there are no slouches on this team. And yeah, I'm me, but I'm trying to find my, you know, my foot in all of this greatness that's going on. So I'm like, okay, let me see what the team needs. I'm like, okay, defense. Like, we have defense, but maybe I could, you know, fit my foot in here real quick. Like, I know offense will come. I know I have offense, but it's like, how can I stay on the floor? How can I stay relevant? You know, just if we're being real. Because it's like, whether you did or not, is you got to figure out how to make sure that the coach does not take you off the floor. So that was kind of my thought process. Like, okay, let me see what I could do on this defensive end. And then I realized, like, oh shit, you're kind of good at it. Like, all right. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, you're having fun with it. So now I'm starting to steal the ball. And if you go back and look at the 2020 tapes, I'm stealing passes and stuff. And I run past the bench and I look at LT and I'll be like, that's one steal. That's two steals. Like, we was talking trash about it. So, you know, so it was one of those things where it started to like entice me to want to like be great at it. So I'm like, all right, I can actually do this. And then now we get to runner up B-Boy and, you know what I mean? And then I go overseas and I get B-Boy in Australia. But it's all been a process. Like, that's why it's like, this has been fun, because it's literally been a process from the first year I've been here to now, you know, in this third year with them. And every year has gotten better. And it's like, I can only keep getting better because there's so much that I can learn through defense.
On that note, can you pinpoint like a game, or maybe there's a possession or a specific matchup to where you had that light bulb moment? Like, oh, wow, I can really do this and do this at a high level.
Like any game?
Yeah, or just like the first memorable one. Where you're like, first memorable one.
I'll say I'll never forget the last season we were playing New York at the Convention Center and I had 7 steals. That game, literally, I don't know what I had before the game or what energy drink I had. I just know my hands were everywhere. So, and it was this one possession, and I think it was before halftime, but Naja Laney was coming down like full head of steam. And I'm like backing up. I'm feel like I'm playing like wide receiver at this point, or like corner, right? That's the position. So like, I'm feel like I'm playing corner and I'm like backing up. And she goes to go like right to left. And I just like bear grab it and take it out her hand. And I like look at her. I'm like, oh, and my team on the bench is yelling. They're like, man, throw the ball. And I'm like, nah, dog. let's just realize what just happened here. Like, I just stripped somebody. That was like my first official like strip. Like, where it was like, give me that. I was like, okay, we have to hold on to this right now. Like, forget the shot. We're going into the half. Like, this is a moment.
You gotta take the ball with you.
Almost did.
I feel that. Just on the defensive side, because you are, again, just watching you over the last couple of years, and specifically this year, you can do it all. Like, you can work as an off-ball chaser, you can be a weak side rotator and just disrupt things at the rim, you can defend pick and rolls on the ball. Like, is there a preferred, like, if you can get into it, is there a preferred role that you like on defense?
Man, it depends on the matchup, right? It depends on the matchup. And I can't get too specific because then I'd give away my secrets.
You know what I mean? Just big picture.
Big picture. Right, it's right. About the matchup because, okay, so I can say like without names, say you have like a scoring guard, right? But then you have a point guard who the only way that this scoring guard can truly, truly get off is if this point guard is getting her the ball. I'm gonna want the point guard. Like, I'm going to want the score, but I'm going to want the point guard because it's like, now I'm getting a 2-for-1 special. I'm making it hard for your scorer to get the ball. And then I'm on the point guard, which allows me, once that ball is out her hand, I can go help. I can go help on the score, which puts the ball back in the point guard, but I already got the point guard. That's the only reason why I got her. It's like, I want to be able to help if there's need for it. You know, so like, that's one of my processes. But honestly, I'd say the most fun position in defense probably help side, and we all know why, because of the blocks. But help side is probably because it's a bait game with me. Like, I like to bait people, like, oh my gosh, it looks like the Red Sea, and then next thing you know, it's like boom, your shot is at half court. So you know, I like help side rotation because it's like so much you could do once you take them 2 steps. It's like you're vulnerable. It's out of there.
Got you. Just as a general defense question, because the adage that I hear all the time is that defense is just about effort and stuff. And like, it is true that you have to have a high energy level. But But like, how much of it for you is just energy and effort, and how much of it is technique, film work, et cetera?
Well, I say energy and effort is like 100%. Like, ain't no drop off of that. It's either you want to play defense or you don't. Because at the end of the day, it's either you want, like, I just don't understand how it's like, it just kind of grinds my gears. Because like, how are you in front of somebody with a ball and it's like, you're okay with them trying to bust your ass? Like, I don't understand that. You know what I mean? Like, somebody is literally trying to embarrass you and compete against. Now, it's competing. They might not be doing it on purpose, but it's like, as a competitor, how is it that I'm okay with you, like, trying to get an easy bucket on me? Because I've been scored on before. Like, there have been some hard buckets that I've had to, like, take on the chin. But I know I give up.
Key word you said right there. It's a hard bucket.
It's a hard bucket.
You're going to have to earn it.
You have to earn that bucket. Like, and if you do, hey, you do. So it's like, I'm okay with that. But at the same time, it's like, how? Like, how you do it? Like, I just don't understand that. I just don't.
What would you say is an underrated aspect of being a good defender?
The IQ. I think people look at the athleticism and people look at, you know, the stats. But people don't realize majority of what really good defenders do not show up on the stat sheet. Like, being in help position all the time, if your teammate's getting beat, you gave your teammate that split second to recover because you were already in the spot, or you're in the help position and now you know they're going to want to pass it to the corner because you're already helping off the strong side and you jump back out. Now it's out of bounds. It's our ball game. You know what I mean? Like, the stat sheet doesn't show how we create turnovers or travels or make the defense think or disrupt the timing of the defense. Like, all that stuff doesn't show up. So I'd say, and that has stuff to do with IQ. If you're looking at film and you know that, okay, a specific play has to go through the four player. If I'm that defensive juggernaut, I'm telling my four player, choke that middle. This pass cannot go through there, because if it do, then it gets here. You know, I'm in XYZ. Yeah. So it's like the IQ part. I don't think people talk about defenders having like a really good IQ of the game, because you really have to understand and know where the ball is going or where they want the ball to go. Once you learn that, that's cheat code. Mm.
This is the stuff I wanted to dig into.
No, it's gems, man. Defense is a mindset. And once you know, hey, I know when she's coming down the right side, I know what play is coming, you've hit a different level.
Yeah. it's like you start to, it start to look like pieces. You're looking at alignments. And even when you're watching the game, you start to like literally call out what's about to happen. So I'm like, oh man. Oh yeah. That's going over there. Oh, you start to see her move a little bit in the back. I'm like, oh, yeah. She done fell asleep. So it's like, you start to see all these things. I'm like, man, I'm ready to play. Like, I know exactly where I'm going to hit. So, defense, it's a mental mind. It's a chess game. It is literally a chess game. It's pieces.
Got you. Who are some of your toughest matchups, and who are some of your favorite players to guard?
Toughest matchups, favorite players to guard. Well, I like to guard anybody that want to compete. Let's just start there. Like, I like to guard anybody that like to compete. I'd say my matchups where like it's fun. I always say playing against Court is hilarious, because you wouldn't think that we were as cool as we look on the court because of how we go at it. But I enjoy her competitiveness. Like, that wakes me up. Like, that keeps me alive when I'm playing in the game. Somebody is just as competitive and wants to win just as bad as you do, but they on the opposite team. It's like, all right, let's see who come out with this one. Right. You know, and then when the buzzer rang, I'm dapping you up like nothing never happened, because like, that's just what we do. You know, that's not who we are. That's not our relationship. You know what I mean? Obviously, playing against Arike is always fun. And I'll even throw Marina in there, because that's a combo that honestly is like, all right, which one am I guarding today? You know, it's kind of a switch off. And throughout the game, I'm guarding both of them. Man, Kelsey Mitchell, that is like an energy bunny. She does not stop moving. Like, it is ridiculous. She's just a motor.
They run her off so many screens.
So many. Oh, I know. and you know, and she's a really great player. You can be as quick as you are, but her skill set allows her to move so freely and have teams on their heels. So it's like, God dang it, Kelsey, just stop moving. Like, that's one of them players where it's like, I need to get you in foul trouble immediately so you could just slow down. Like, I need to slow you down, make you think a little bit. But if, on top of my head, those three for sure are probably like my favorite top three.
On the defensive end, who are some of the players that took you under their wing, or who are some players that you watched? Like, okay, I can take this angle of her game or his game, but whoever you watch, like, who are you drawing from defensively?
Well, my rookie year, I'd say we had Sancho Little, and I don't think exactly right. You know who Sancho Little is.
Yeah.
I've never seen a four player so smart. Like, her defensive IQ literally had my mouth on the floor. Like, I sat with her one time, and Sancho was one of them vets that you don't really talk to. She don't really got enough, like, a lot of words for you. So one day she was riding a bike, and she had like stole a pass in the game one time. I'm like, how did she, like, you know, like, I was just like, how did you do that? And so I asked her, and she's like, and you know, she has an accent, so like she's talking to me, and she was like, go on now, leave me alone. And I'm like, nah, Sancho, like, I really want to know, like, please, like, help me. So once she realized that I was being serious, she was like, okay. And then she ended up telling me that defense with steals, she was like, you want to bait them into thinking that something's open. Knowing that once the ball is in the air, that's when, you know, you make your move and you do your work early. So that's kind of a reason why I kind of bait, other than the fact that it's like, I like playing that game with people. I remember her vividly telling me that it was a bait game, that you want to make them think that something's open or something's there. And then that's when you kind of strike and make your move. So Sancho Little for sure helped me out. And then, I mean, obviously I watched the likes of Marcus Smart, even Murray on the Spurs, Peyton on the Warriors. I'm a huge fan of him. Like, his defense is ridiculous. But also, oh my gosh, why do I see his face and I can't think of his name? He's on the Bulls. I love his defense.
Alex Caruso.
Yes, Caruso. There we go. Caruso. I love Caruso's defense. I don't know why people don't talk about it the way they should, but that man's defense is ridiculous, especially his help side blocks. Like, his, he just comes out of nowhere. He's blocking shots. He's deflecting the ball on dribbles. Like, those are the things that again, does not show up on the stat sheet, because you might not get the steal, but you created the havoc that created that opportunity for them to go down and get a score. So, big fan of his. I like watching certain players and how they play.
That made me think of a quick question. My mind was going, your defensive evolution, your mindset, has that helped you offensively as far as the evolution with the playmaking goes?
Yeah, I think it allows me to get into an offensive flow early. Whereas some players might, who are like offensively dominant, that might dictate how their game goes. Whereas my offensive game might be off. I might not make a shot, but I know that at the end of the night, whoever I'm guarding, they might not make a shot either, because I'm, you know, I'm guarding. So, you know, it's one of those things where I've realized that defense is always going to be there every night. Offense, it could come, it could go, you know, at any moment. But like, defense is there every night. So I try to make defense my staple. That way, when offense does come, it's like the defense kind of like sparks the offense, and then now the offense starts flowing. So then it's like, okay, even if the offense kind of chills off, you still got that defensive tenacity, which kind of leads into creating for others. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, defense is going to give me either or. It's either a night where I'm doing offense, or it's a night where I'm really, really creating, you know, and then there's a wonderful night where I do both. So, but it all stems from defense and the energy that defense creates that allows like our team to get out and just go and run.
All right. I only have a couple more for you. We get you out of here. What are practices like with that guard room in LA? It seems like a lot of different styles. Man, there.
Oh man, for sure. It's obviously you could just pick your poison with whoever you have, you know, as a guard. You got shooting and Lexi and, you know, Katie Lou. You got athleticism, mid-range, crazy game with me. You have the speed of Kennedy and Jordan, you know, with the playmaking abilities of everybody who touches the ball, you know, across the board. So when we're in practice, when we do get to go against each other, the different combos, it's dang it. You know, like what can you do? What can you do? You just have to honestly just grit, bear it, and just play some defense, because at the end of the day, they're on our team. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we don't have to prepare for them. They got to prepare for us. So we just make each other better, and that's it.
Got you. And my last one, you made an all-defensive team in 2020, made all-defense first team last year. The defensive player of the year case has, you know, the campaign has started for you. There was a campaign last year as well. Why are you the defensive player of the year right now?
Man, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be honest. I don't even think I've really truly tapped into what it is to, like, what I want DePoy to be. Like, I don't think I've truly, it's been maybe 12 games so far. It's been a hell of a May, you know, and for what it was, we did what we had to do and we came out with how we came out, right? So I think that within this month, obviously the rest of the season, but for sure this month, we get like 2 weeks of a break without having crazy games. And we got like 3 games in like 2 weeks, something like that. So I'll have time to sit with my coaches, watch them do all these things, because I'm really, really, I've said it last year, I think, or the year before, where I really want people to understand what it is to be a defensive player of the year. Cause it's not just blocks. It's not just steals. It's not just rebounds. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a guard, not to say that I can't rebound as a guard, but what I'm doing on the perimeter, I got 6'9" and 6'3" and 6'4" down there. I'm probably not going to get 7 rebounds, you know, as easy as the 4, 3 or 4, 6'2" and above would, you know what I mean? Or they're down there in the paint, because I'm sitting up here guarding the point guard. I'm probably not going to be in there like that. So, you know, it's like, but how does that take away from my defensive capability because I'm not grabbing defensive rebounds? Like, the math not mathing with that one.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, I want to be able to, like, set the standard, set a bar, or create a new standard to what it is. Like, I want people to look at advanced stats where it's like, this person's on the floor, this team has this much of a chance to win. Whereas when they're not on the floor, when they're guarding the player, their statistics are point da 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 below average, as when, you know what I mean? Like, I want people to look at those, because that's what matters. That's what matters. And obviously, like, winning and losing matters, but don't get me started on that, because it's like, I don't understand how that takes away from somebody's individual capability. But at the same time, I do agree that, hey, if you are that person, why is your team losing? You know, so it's like, it goes both ways. So it's one of those things where that's why I'm trying to create that standard of, like, all right, they see DePoy, they see me, like.
I got you. And like I said at the top, like, I think that's what makes you a special defender and someone easy to see, because you pop on the screen. Like, you do all the things that don't show up on the stat sheet. But also, you're second in the league in steals right now. You're first in total steals. Like, you're leading guards and blocks right now. So, like, you have the mix of everything right now. And if you're about to get this break and watch more film, I ain't no telling what you're about to do on the defensive end at this point. It's been a wildly impressive season so far. So thank you for hopping on with us. Is there anything you want to plug? Where can the people find you? What are you getting into off the court, if you can share?
Oh, man. I mean, it's plenty. I mean, if we have a chance to run it back and do another interview somewhere, you know, down the line in the season, for sure. Probably be looking for a website. Most likely, all my socials are the same, Grit Bundles with the Z at the end. And yeah, I mean, just look out for me on the game. Vote for me for All-Star. Obviously, All-Star is coming up, so you guys push me. For sure, push me for All-Star. That'd be the dopest. Because that's definitely a goal this year. I'm trying to get out there. It's about that time. Time is a ticking.
There we go. Oh, one quick thing. You're doing some work for Game 3 of the NBA Finals. Can you shed some insight into what that is?
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm going to be on ABC. And I'm going to be talking about Game 3. I believe, I'm not sure. I forgot who our my co-host is. Lord, I hope I don't get in trouble. But I think I'm with Norm. But and I did it with him last year around this time for finals when it was Bucks and Phoenix. So it'd be pretty cool to come around because, you know, he's a Laker and I'm a Celtics fan. So that should be a pretty cool dynamic on camera. But I'm looking forward to it. But I just go up there. We talk about the finals. We talk about things that have been happening in the sports world. And it's just a good little laugh. They're probably going to, you know, ask me questions about the season, check in with the Sparks. And obviously, I'm going to tell people, and I'm telling you guys, make sure you tell them, tune in to the WNBA, because yes, that is amazing basketball, amazing basketball. And this season is crazy. And we have a home game this week against Vegas at the Crypto Arena. So make sure you tell people, come out, support, come see your fans in Vegas. I mean, they're a great team, so it's going to be a great game. I'm looking forward to it.
That it is, that it is. Thank you again for coming on. We really appreciate it. Best of luck to you for the rest of the season. And if there's an interview opportunity, I'm absolutely going to take you up on that. So don't be timing, especially for the All-Star team. So.
No, we definitely will run this back. And we make All-Star. We're not saying if I don't, like that's the goal. So we make All-Star, we run this back, and we're gonna talk about whatever we done did these last 2 months. We ain't speak. How about that?
All right. Sounds good. Sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Before we fully transition into the NBA finals and some NBA news, do you have any W takes from the weekend?
Well, I think this W season is just really, really fun. There's a lot of quality teams, and it's a good time if you're not necessarily watching, get into it, because you're starting to learn more about each team. And it's really tight between, what, 3 through 8, you could say,
yeah,
to a degree. And you're getting to the point where you're learning about a team, you're understanding their identity, what they do well, what they struggle with, what they're trying to do, and you can kind of track that. And as the season progresses, like, they're getting different challenges. Like, the Mystics are such a fascinating up-and-down team where they're really good, and then EDD doesn't play. And then you watch them, it's like, oh, they really need their defense to do well. And then it's like, oh, no, they're just actually really good. And then you look at the Chicago Sky, just, oh, it's coming together. Yeah. Oh, here's the defense. Oh, the offense is there. Like, I watched Sky Dream, and the message they sent to the Dream early in that game was a message and a half. It's like, actually, that's the defense that you guys bring to the table. I get it.
Yeah, like, Ryan Howard, you're just not having a good time tonight. I'm sorry. Great season so far. Great career ahead of you. Not tonight. You're just not going to be able to do it. Like, we are on your side for all the fancy screening actions that Atlanta wants to run. Oh, you want to run a pick and roll? Yeah, here's Candace Parker. Here's Emma Mieseman stepping up and taking away airspace. Have fun with that. Like, oh boy.
And right when you start to think, like, oh, the Sky, this is the problem, they're in the mud, they drop 90 on the Mystics. And it's like, oh, okay. And yeah, even when you're like, oh, the Dream, young team, I get it. They kept playing in that game against the Sky. Like, mm-hmm, they have a belief in what they do. And even, like, when they were struggling, it never fazed them. They just kept doing it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the fun stuff. You see Seattle going through everything they're going through. They find their defense, and now here they come back with scoring, and it's like, oh yeah,
they can do the thing.
That's a thing that can happen. And you got the Sparks, talented as all heck, coming together. We're gonna talk about the Liberty this week. We're gonna skip that.
Oh, what do you mean? The Liberty are on
the Aces.
The Liberty are on the upswing. I think it's fair to acknowledge. Like, we would have got full blown Capital S Steve on the pod had the Liberty completed their, you know, got the win over the Lynx on Sunday. They did not, but even so,
just had to bring that up, man. Things are coming together. Sabrina's figuring it out. Anzu is fun. The defense is coming together. Rebecca Allen is helping that lineup. Stephanie Dolson's defense. Ooh, buddy. Anyways,
good Stephanie Dolson week, huh?
But, you know, Aces are still at the top. Son of rep behind them, but You know, you know what season, you know what season it is right now, Doug.
Yes, Aces season. What do you mean?
No, the hashtag is MV Plum, folks.
Ah, there it is. There it is. Huge shout out to Kelsey Plum, one player of the week, rightfully so. Basically averaged 24-7, shot 43% from three during the week. She's been incredible. On Sunday, she played all 40 minutes against the Dallas Wings, which, brief aside, what they did to the Seattle Storm was pretty interesting on Friday.
The hashtag is big plug, folks.
The big plug. Satu Sabally at the five. Interesting. Wrote about what her versatility could do at the five on basketballnews.com. You can check that out if you have not already. Thank you, Steve, for the lob. I had to slam it down. Anyway, Aces Wings on Sunday. Officiating atrocity. Let's put that out there first. Two, Kelsey Plum was amazing. Three, man, do the Aces need a wing. Raquana Williams is already out with injury. Played, I think, the first game of the season she's been out since. Jackie Young got injured during the second game against the Connecticut Sun on Thursday, which, heck of a win from set tone early. Again, Aces just couldn't complete the comeback. But man, Kelsey Plum's shot making is so important for this Aces. The blend of pull-up shooting and playmaking just makes the offense go. And on a night where they were without Jackie Young, who kind of provides some jabs for him as a driver and also as a pull-up shooter, and without Asia Wilson to close the game, because for, like, I don't really advocate for, like, star calls, but it's also weird to see, like, a superstar get that kind of whistle at home. She fouled out, and, like, all but one of her fouls were atrocious. It was insane. But at any rate, a lot of three big lineups for the Aces to try to compensate for Jackie Young being out, and then you lose Asia. But there's Kelsey Plum, and it just didn't matter who defended her. It didn't matter what coverage she saw. She's mixing in the pull-ups with the drives, and if you commit too much, she's dishing it out to an open teammate. She's pushing it in transition and finding Derek Hamby streaking down the right side of the court. Like, Kelsey Plum is in such control of this Aces offense, both in the half court and in transition. It's incredible. And again, you've been on the MV Plum train in some of our watch parties. I'm starting to see it more on the timeline. We have some other WNBA media members saying, hey, you might need to start talking about Kelsey Plum for MVP now. I'm just like, huh, I wonder where I heard that first. Cool. But all that stuff aside, Kelsey Plum's been incredible. The Aces remain on top of the league standings right now. They are 10-2. A lot of fun happening in Vegas right now.
And there's our weekly Aces rant from Nikias.
need a
sponsor for this segment.
Like, someone needs to do. Hey, man, if Vegas wants to sponsor the pod, that'd be cool. Summer League's coming up.
All of Vegas?
All of Vegas. The entirety of Vegas.
That's not good for your brand, bud.
You know what? That's a good point. If we could just get, Aces play what? Mandalay Bay? I think that's the hotel. Like, just let that specific sponsor, you know, watch some games. Hotel is set for Summer League. July's coming up soon. You know, just set it up. All right. Anyway.
LMBO is going to be a lot different.
Not co-signing that one. The NBA Finals. Woo, basketball. Woo. The NBA Finals are now tied up at 1-1. I am not doing this with you today. Anyway, it was a entertaining-ish first quarter in game two when the refs were doing the thing. But the shot making perked up in the end of the first quarter. Second quarter was a back and forth affair. Very cool. And then the third quarter happened, where the Warriors just kind of said, you know what? We don't really believe in the tough shot making that Jason Tatum was pulling off in the first half. They had 21 in the first half. Those early clock threes and early clock pull-ups that Jaylen Brown was getting in the first quarter, I don't think that's going to continue. We're going to continue to switch and mix in different coverages against Jason Tatum, depending on what the lineup is. Saw some switching. He saw some shows and recovers. We saw an occasional trap against him. That was cool. And it just felt like the well just kind of dried up for Boston in the half court. And there was some process stuff that bothered me in the first half, too. But, like, in the third quarter, it really dried up. They didn't get those tough shots to go. And then you just kind of felt like, once the jumper stopped falling, it really stood out. Hey, they're not really getting to the rim at all in this game. That's a tough diet to live on. And Golden State was able to push on the other end. Steph Curry was able to take advantage. Jordan Poole was able to show up in a big way. And the next thing you know, the Warriors have outscored Boston by like 20 in the third. It's like, oh, well, this was a fun game. Let's roll out the backups now. We have extended garbage time because Boston just could not get anything to go offensively. On top of their turnover issues, they were back in a big way in game two. And Golden State was just able to find enough on offense where the Celtics were just out of reach by the time the fourth quarter started.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting first two games where we've had a lot of quality basketball ended by a massive run from each side. I think to your initial Boston point about them offensively, Boston, again, is a unique offensive team as far as championship contender goes. You talk about the shot diet. That shot making we've spoken about is a part of the process for them. It's a piece of what they do. And it does help them in those stretches where they're trying to find a pressure point. They're searching for something that can sustain them. They can't live on it. And so we saw in the Miami series, dribble penetration became the equalizer on top of the shot making. And then they added the pressure points. And now you have a sort of blend. They need the shot making to sustain them while they're searching for the pressure points. And Golden State's defense really didn't allow many pressure points in that game. I thought Golden State's defense was, they played defense with conviction for what felt like the first time probably since the Dallas series. It felt early Dallas series to me. We're looking for a comparison. They knew what they wanted to do. They executed it. They attacked. And going bigger picture, one of the things that I thought was huge is it felt like Golden State kind of pointed at Boston's pick and roll game and said, hey, what's this look like if we take this off the menu? What's this look like if it's not the same kind of pressure point? If we just switch and you're going to have Robert Williams roll, you're going to have Al Horford roll to the dunker. And we're going to force it, funnel that dribble penetration, whatever drive you want, right to that help. And there's going to be help from the corner. There's going to be help from the wing. And we're going to help from the other corner as well. That's what we're going to do. And now it's on Boston to kind of take that and manipulate the spacing. We've seen them do it before. We've seen them beat a Milwaukee team that sold out protecting the paint. We saw them beat a Miami team that sold out on early help. Now they have to find the creases against this Golden State team because where do you put who? Where do you space the right people at the right time? How does Al Horford get comfort if he's just spaced? When he tries to cut, is it a cut with purpose? Is Jaylen Brown best served on the wing? How do you kind of manipulate that to keep the pressure on Golden State is what's interesting, going to be interesting for me going forward. But I thought Golden State's defense was very, 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 very tough. Very tough.
Well, let's start right there. Let's talk about Golden State's defense. Let's start with the obvious shift from Golden State in game two. The first possession of the game, Draymond Green set the tone. We're going to talk about Draymond's defense because it was insane all game long. First possession of the game, 10 seconds in, Al Horford's above the break, looking to flow into a handoff or maybe a pitch to flow into a pick and roll. Draymond Green's like, nah, let me just chew up the space. We're going to grab the ball. We're going to force a jump ball. And Boston retains possession, but that right there let me know, okay, yeah, Draymond's here.
Oh, no, he was on demon time. And I wish I could be a esteemed media member, because I would have asked my question, at what date and time did you decide that that was what you were going to do on the first possession? Because there's no way that was an accident. It felt like that man did that on purpose. But anyways, continue.
So Draymond sets the tone there. And then after that, we see Draymond get his, I guess, the primary assignment. He gets Jaylen Brown in this one. This is a gambit that we saw Golden State go to in the Western Conference Finals, where they put Draymond Green on Jalen Brunson early in the series, which seemed to be like, hey, Jaylen Brown kind of hurt us as a driver in game one, particularly in that fourth quarter run. We want to make sure those drives aren't there. And beyond that, if Jason Tatum has the ball above the break, we know they like the space Jaylen Brown in the strong side corner. If Peyton Pritchard's in the game, they'll stash him in the strong side corner. They'll have Jaylen Brown would pass away. We're going to put Draymond on Jaylen Brown. So now wherever you place him, and in theory, you want to make things tough. Now that helper is Draymond Green. And he just happens to be one of the best defensive players of the generation. And an elite guy at stunting at a drive or stunning at a ball handler in a pick and roll and then recovering back out to his man. So Jaylen Brown, space, strong side, cool. Helping from the strong side is a no-no, cool. Draymond can do it. And so now your best option is taken off the table. And now your only other option is to drive to the opposite side where we're setting up all this help. This is where you have Marcus Smart space. This is where you may have Robert Williams in the dunker spot. This is where you may have Derek White if he's on the court. And so now we're just pinching in on one side. The other side is Draymond Green waiting to pounce on your dribble, which as much as we talk about Jaylen Brown's handle not being the best, and it isn't, Jason Tatum doesn't have an elite handle either. And so you're cramping space for him, which when you zoom out, if you want to go big picture, one of the things we talked about before the series was like, hey, winning the paint battle is going to be very important. It's going to be very important. Who can generate paint touches? Who can get to the rim? Who can get to the free throw line? This was kind of the big thing about Boston starting with two bigs. Like part of having Robert Williams, Al Horford in your front line is like on the other end, you're not getting anything on the paint. And depending on how we space and how we attack elsewhere, Robert Williams is going to have to paint to himself on the other end. He'll have dump offs in the dunker spot. He can make an impact as an offensive rebounder, et cetera, et cetera. Boston wasn't able to generate enough goodness in the half court to where the Robert Williams stuff would matter. And then on the other end, as you said, like Golden State was just a lot more calculated in their attack. It did seem to shift to more pick and rolls and stuff. But back to Golden State's defense, I was just wildly impressed with what Draymond Green was able to do on the ball, off the ball, taking on a multitude of matchups at a time. We saw him on Jason Tatum. We saw him on Jaylen Brown. We saw him on Al Horford. And he just did a little bit of everything. Like there was a play in the third quarter as the run was happening where Boston runs an action for Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown is now on the, I want to say the left wing, getting ready to set up a pick and roll with Robert Williams with an empty side. And Draymond's like, oh, yeah, we're just going to trap this. Gets into Jaylen Brown's body. Kevon Looney gets up there. It's a live ball turnover, which Boston think 19 turnovers in game two. You can't have that. Just the engagement level, the way that they took away the paint completely, it turned Boston into more of an isolation in the mud offense. And again, the shot making was there in the first half, particularly from Jason Tatum. But once that stopped, they didn't really have a counter. And I attribute a lot of that to what Golden State was able to do from an energy standpoint and also just from a scheme slash game plan.
Nah, you got to give Draymond his due. Give him his credit. Listen to the pod. Make a meme. Do whatever you got to do.
There you go.
You know, I know the Draymond Brown matchup is going to catch the headlines, but I thought what Draymond did was so important. You hit on it. He guarded multiple people for Boston and did multiple things. Active on the ball. We're going to take away these pick and rolls, take away some of these handoffs. But even with the Brown matchup, he was still unlocked as a help defender. And that was key. And part of that is a tip of the cap to Klay Thompson, to Andrew Wiggins for being able to do multiple things defensively to where we could switch and now you can give that same early help. I know where you're coming, and I can still get back out. But that's the thing. I think the matchup may have engaged him a little bit more. So now those closeouts looked a lot different than they did in game one. And Draymond is one of those top defenders as far as help and recover goes. And when he's engaged like that, you have Steph Curry working to do his job, you know, setting the tone, keeping the ball on the side and picking a roll, pressuring it, helping off ball, making efforts. I'm not going to be that guy, but he did his job. He clocked in and he clocked out defensively. We'll put it that way. And then the bigs, hey, you want me to switch? Keep it one way? I thought it was just a really, really strong effort. The most impressive part for me with Golden State's defense was that they found a way to defend, but they kept their base and their principles. And like that was really important after that game one where it looked like Boston's smaller lineup just put them in a tough spot. But they were back to showing early help. They were back to closing out with purpose. There was multiple efforts. There was conviction. Like we talk about the three phases of defense all the time.
Are you dictating? Are you anticipating? Are you reacting? I thought Golden State was able to live in the last two. And if you're able to live in the last two phases, you're in good shape. Pay the bills there. You'll be all right.
There you go.
So, I mean, what do you think Boston could do? Because I know you mentioned you were annoyed with the spacing. And I feel like that's going to be a nice little buzzword over the next 24 to 36 hours. Is it the spacing or is the lack of manipulating Golden State's defense?
I think they kind of go hand in hand as like the cheating answer. You know, that's fine. Yeah. Bring it in. But no, I think it's more so where there's, I think it's more the manipulation. And like, as the half court offense was bad, 77 offensive rating in the half court in game two after a 114 offensive rating in game one. That's a pretty big split. Like Boston did try to do some things to move Draymond Green around. Like they did have him, you know, going over some off ball screens for Jaylen Brown to set up some other stuff. They opened the third quarter with like this hammer play for Jaylen Brown in the left corner that almost worked. And so like you could see them experimenting with some stuff like, okay, if Draymond's going to have the Jaylen Brown assignment, how do we get Jaylen the ball on the move? Or at the very least, how do we occupy Draymond so we can run some other stuff and not worry about him as a helper? And I think they were able to poke at enough to where they can at least feel decent about what they can do in game three. I'll even say just, I guess, zooming out, like a lot of this is on Boston. Like there were some weird spacing things. The decision-making just was not there for Boston. And Golden State's
been waiting for the turnover rant. Buckle up, folks. Get yourself a nice snack.
I don't know if it's a turnover rant, but like Boston, as good as Golden State's defense was, Boston also just shot themselves in the foot with some weird pass. Like there was the Jason Tatum cut where Marcus Smart tries to throw a bounce pass to lead Jason Tatum where the ball is like 6 feet outside of Jason Tatum, goes right to, I think, Kevon Looney. I'm just like, yo, you can't do that. What is happening? It wasn't a great floor game for Marcus Smart, period. I guess he wasn't the only culprit, obviously. But like, they need Marcus Smart activated as a ball handler, because as you've mentioned on this pod plenty of times, if Marcus Smart can get downhill for you, if he can make some plays for you, if he can force some rotations for you, he's kicking to the Jays. And that's generally what you want to get the chain moving in the half court for Boston. If Marcus Smart is turning the ball over, or if he's making passes a split second too late to where you may have created a small crack in Golden State's defense, but now they're able to recover out because you didn't make the pass quickly enough. Now you're up against the said defense again. And Boston can't afford to get like that against Golden State. And with the turnovers, like, one, they lost the turnover battle. Golden State absolutely blitzed them in transition on the other. Like, even off of just defensive rebounds, Golden State was able to flow into some early pull-ups or get downhill and get some early passes, get to the rim. They got to tighten the screws there. They have to tighten the screws there.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is Golden State being a moving target defensively. They didn't necessarily give them the automatics. And say what you want about Boston's offense, in both of their previous series, they're at least automatics they knew they could get to. There are pressure points they knew they could get to. In this game, too, didn't feel like they were always present because you had Draymond in multiple different positions. You had switching in pick and roll. You had Steph Curry switching, but then also showing and recovering. You had Poole switching, but also built in help. So it wasn't like the one thing they could necessarily pick at. And it's going to be on them to find it and probably play with a little bit more of a purpose on the offensive end. Make some quicker decisions on the offensive end. And I thought Tatum had some good moments making quick early decisions, but how much can they do to get him in the post? Can they unlock him that way? Can they throw something different on the table against Golden State? It felt like Boston maybe had felt like they had found a formula and Golden State had an answer. And so Boston was back to searching. Now I want to see what it looks like in game three.
I'm with you on that. While we're still on Boston's offense, I guess one of the heroes of game one was Al Horford in his 26 points and his NBA Finals debut, six made threes. He took four shots in game two. His first shot attempt was logged with, I think, 10:38 left in the third quarter. How much of that was Golden State taking him away, and how much of that was Boston not looking, if that makes sense? Like, what did you see on the Horford?
I just thought the switching impacted him. Where were they going to look for him? Unless they started throwing it to him in the post. It's not like they had the drive and kick game going to the same degree. So I think that impacted him because he wasn't able to play out of the same flow. He didn't necessarily get the same kicks, the same looks, and the defense was right there. So I don't necessarily think it was a Al didn't take the shots type deal. I just think Boston necessarily may not have been as ready for that element that Golden State threw at them. But they're going to need Al Horford on both ends of the floor. And I say both ends of the floor for a reason. I was laughed off of this podcast when I said Golden State has to try and find a way to make Al Horford a pressure point. And guess what they tried to do in that first quarter?
Tried to make him, well, wait a minute, before we even answered it, what's who up? Laughed you off the pod about that?
Nokia Duncan?
Who? That is not what I remember. I was there. There is film.
Did you just hit me with the "we saw you"?
Yes.
All right. We're off to playing all the hits tonight.
We here. No rim pressure for Boston. Okay.
No, but that was a key for me. Like, I know we're going to talk about the pick and roll and the pick and roll numbers, and everyone's waiting for Golden State to run pick and roll. We're going to say pick and roll for the next 2 days. Pick, roll. What took you so long? But they've said, hey, Al Horford, come here. And Steph Curry does present a different challenge for Al Horford in the sense that it's not an automatic switch you want to give up all the time. And it's one thing to work to get to the level. I think he has the nuance to get up there, drop back. But it's a lot when they throw the rescreens out there, when you have to mix in the off-ball actions. When you mix in the switching that Al sometimes switched on Curry, you get to thinking a lot. And now all of a sudden you throw in Draymond with a fake handoff. And now it's like, wait, what's happening?
It's a lot to navigate.
So I hit on Williams being the one, but if they can get Al into that kind of zone, now that makes things interesting. And I think he'll be all right back in Boston, but we know how important he is to Boston's team. And if I'm Golden State, I got to find a way to keep getting him involved, getting him in action, making him a part of this.
It was, I thought of you as I was rewatching the game earlier today. I'm just like, huh, he's been saying nobody in the postseason has been able to make Al Horford a pressure point yet. And in the game too, Golden State, without it, the pick and roll numbers would say like they were okay going against Al. Like it wasn't a blitzing like the Robert Williams numbers, and we'll talk about him a little bit later. But one crack, I saw a crack there. The one that kept going after him. Two, it was kind of weird to see some of the sideline plays. It's like, wait, why is Al Horford already on Steph? What is this? Is this by design? Are they planning to switch some stuff? Because Golden State can just flatten this out and attack. That's not smart. But I want to say the second quarter, when Golden State goes to one of their smaller units, Draymond's at the five. Then they had Otto Porter out there too. They had Gary Payton the second on the floor. And so it was one of those after a dead ball possession. Inbound to Steph. Steph calls for Gary Payton the second to set a screen. And then Al Horford calls for a pre-switch on this pick and roll. And I was like, wait a minute. We haven't seen that from Al Horford. We've seen that from Robert Williams a few times. We ain't really seen that from Al Horford. If Al Horford's calling for the pre-switch, like, I'm not about to get up there. That's a problem because he's the big, even in game one, and we talked a little bit about the drop coverage that Steph saw in first quarter game one and stuff like that. But he was the big where it's like, okay, well, you know, Al's at the level of the screen and drop it back. We have to worry about him like we have to worry about Robert Williams. And again, we'll talk about him a little bit later. Al Horford was still at the level in game two, and there was some switching, and he had to work when defending Steph. But once I saw the pre-switch, I'm like, oh boy, let's keep an eye on this. Again, statistically, like the pick and rolls with Al Horford as the screen defender were not bad for Boston. But just from a process standpoint, if we're starting to see that in the game too, I have to think Golden State's like, we might have something. We don't have it in game three. We got it.
So much of the work is to make a team think or to make a team blink. And if that team blinks, you know you got something cooking. You know you got something that you can go back to. You know you've got them in a different space. Like, even, I know we're not talking about Robert Williams left, but the work they have to do with his minutes to start the game, subconsciously, even if you do it well, it becomes an issue. Like, you need that to be solid. Like, I need you to be able to set your alarm, get dressed, get your food ready, and then be ready to go. I can help you with all that, but that's not the point.
Yeah.
Was that Dunker Dad analysis there?
Yes. Yes. Yes, it was. That's what I'm talking about. Folks, you will get all of the basketball analysis and parenting advice that you need on this here podcast. Who else gives you the blend like this? This is what it's all about, right?
But no, you gotta know your personnel. You gotta know the mornings when you gotta help. Anyways, continue.
You know what? While we're here, let's go ahead and transition to Robert Williams. Am I allowed to do a pre-plug? Because I am currently recording on a Monday.
Historic Dunker Spot episode. We had a whole active roster player, and now you're doing a pre-plug?
We're doing a pre-plug.
Plugging an article that's not even finished? What kind of nonsense is this?
Because here's why I have to do this, right?
What are you writing about? Marcus Smart? What is this?
No. I am writing about Robert Williams and the way that he has been used/attacked through the first two games of the series. We're recording on a Monday night. Pod's going to drop Tuesday morning. By the time you listen to it, the article may be out, but it's coming out on Tuesday. We'll just put it out there.
Is it done?
Not done yet. I have clips ready. We got.
I'm keeping my takes.
boo. See, and this is what I was going to flow into. Because, see, I have to pre-plug this. Because what I'll do, I'll end up writing on something, and then you'll quote tweet with, wait a minute. I'm just like, no, I already have my own notes on this. I'm watching the same game you are. You are smarter than me. But I am also watching this. This is, we have at basketballnews.com, to peel the curtain back a little bit, we have a writer's meeting every Monday morning at 11:30 Eastern to talk about what we plan on writing for the week. So I have to get this out early and on record that I am already, it is documented that I am writing about Robert Williams Tuesday. I am not going to be hit with the wait a minute or the hashtag if only. No more. No more. Not happening.
Oh, the hashtag is big mad, folks.
Yeah, that felt good. That felt good. We had to get that out of there. This is a legendary pod episode already. This is some good stuff. Anyway, while we are on the subject of Robert Williams, boy, this is getting tough for Boston to navigate. I touched on the offense a little bit earlier, to where Boston has to create cracks in order to open up Rob Williams as a roller or as like a dump off threat in the dunker spot. If Golden State is switching to this degree and the roles aren't there, that already puts Robert Williams in a very confined box, which makes it a lot tougher for him to get involved. And once you factor in, again, Draymond on Jaylen Brown, that affects the overall spacing, because if Brown's taken away, your other spacers are Al Horford, depending on where he is. And if you're putting him and Robert Williams on the same side of the floor, that's going to be a little easier help in the paint for Golden State. And the spacer is Marcus Smart most of the time, which Golden State is okay with him shooting. Draymond told you as much as on his podcast. So the offensive impact hasn't really been there for Robert Williams. And then there's the defensive. We talked about this heading into the series, like, hey, where are they going to put Rob? Because what made part of what made Boston's defense click in the calendar year of 2022 was MA Udoka saying, hey, we're just going to put you on non-spacing, weak spacing wing, park yourself at the paint, be a deterrent. Golden State doesn't give you an easy help point. You put him on Kevon Looney, he's just going to flow into a bunch of off-ball screening actions. That's going to be a problem. You put him on Draymond Green, it's a similar ordeal. You have to worry about fake handoffs, all the good stuff. Andrew Wiggins was where I landed.
And tell me about it, King.
Andrew Wiggins was where I landed. I was like, you know what? This is probably their best opportunity to pull off that particular gambit. And in game one, we saw some early screens, some early handoffs for Andrew Wiggins. Like, okay. And then they started flowing into some cuts. I was like, ooh, okay. And in game two, Golden State continued to poke at him in different ways. Let's run this off-ball action. With Boston being a little bit more willing to switch Robert Williams, that means, hey, you're on Klay Thompson now. That's not what you want. Hey, you're on Steph Curry now. There was a play in the first half where you got to switch with Robert Williams on Steph Curry. Jason Tatum immediately calls for the pre-switch, like, or the scram switch. Like, nope, get out of here. No, I got Steph. And so then you get a cut the other way. And now you have, I think it was Jaylen Brown and Robert Williams going the same way. And Kevon Looney's just left alone underneath the basket. Like, wait, that's not how that's supposed to work. And so now they're starting to pick at the off-ball stuff. The on-ball stuff, you already see what the issue was. You know, he's in a deeper drop than Al because zooming out. Not only is this a tough matchup for him, he's also compromised because of the knee. And so now I think he only played 14 minutes in game two. And so my question now becomes, like, how much can you play Robert Williams right now? Is it time for them to, I guess it's two things. Like, is it time for them to transition to Al Horford? You're starting at the five now. And do you go Grant Williams to start in this place and see if you can juice him? Because quiet is kept, Grant Williams has not had a good series through two games. Like, is this a way to engage him and get him going? Or,
oh, he's been engaged.
Yeah.
He's been engaged. We can play the pause on that because you got a great point going. I'm not gonna go there. He's been awfully engaged. I don't know. Well, first off, I hope Robert Williams' leg and knee is okay. Number one, health is important. Number two, I don't know if you can go backwards. You can shorten the stint and shorten the rotation or try and match it, you know, take his first run and then try and match him with pneumonia in the second quarter or something like that, even though that's not ideal. Maybe it gives you something different. The issue is now the blend of your biggest impact is a pro rebounding and then rolling where your roles are a switch. Good luck, as you stated. And then on the other end, we're just going to keep gnawing at you. Like, the tone setter for me for Golden State was, hey, first play, Andrew Wiggins handoff. Okay. Interesting. Like, you could say we'll live with that, but the mindset is not so much. Now you got Wiggins bringing the ball up, coming off a double drag.
Yep.
Okay. You guys pre-switched last game. Now you're pre-switching off ball. Fun times. That's tough because now he's a moving target. And that's on top of already the things we saw as far as just having to do more of this series, as far as being at the level, not being at the level, help recover closeouts. Now there's more to it because he's in more actions. And then on the other end, it's screen roll to the dunker. Maybe you can get him some more slips, but that two big lineup not having the same impact is huge, especially with the way the Draymond Green views Grant Williams.
Yeah. So two things before I let you continue. One, because you mentioned the a little bit of the paint battle. And you mentioned the roles for Robert Williams turning into a switch. You also mentioned the rebounding. Golden State has been doing the thing on the offensive glass, and that hasn't really stopped with Robert Williams on the floor. So, like, you're not really getting that either right now. Two, I made sure to start with Draymond Green praise at the beginning of this.
All right, hold on. You can't get mad at Draymond Green's antics when you champion Chris Paul's antics. You got to keep the same antic level.
It's less that. Like, I appreciate gamesmanship. But, like, also, with the interactions with him and Grant Williams in particular, they were just a lot. I'll just put it that way. They were a lot. You can continue.
Oh, no, you're just trying to end that, man.
Saying you want to be me, that's some trash talk for you.
He said a lot more than that, too.
I mean, that's also true.
Side note, salute to the whoever's on the 7-second delay. I had a long night. Draymond was driving in the paint. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
But to say, like, the toughest insults, especially, you know, in life, but on the court, are ones with just a smidge of truth to it. You're not me. You want to be me. It's not that far off. Right. kind of like, what role is Grant Williams kind of playing?
Like, yeah. That's kind of tough.
Right?
Yeah.
And you combine that with not playing well while someone's saying that to you. That's just never a good combo. That man was upset. I understand it.
I mean, you got the full court pressure.
Full court press on Draymond with a denial afterwards. That's personal. No offense to Grant Williams. That is football player behavior.
Football player behavior.
Someone out there is going to know what I mean.
The hashtag is Big Gridiron, folks.
That is the running back that got scored on twice. You said something to him, and now he wants to put the clamps on. If you don't back up, go take your cross trainers and go lift some weights. All right, dog?
The cross trainers. This is, oh, man. I once again say this is already a legendary episode of the Dunker Spot. We have gone many a places already. But I guess just to recenter it, pun intended, Grant Williams is going to be important moving forward. Like, even if he doesn't like take over Rob Williams' starting position, as you said, maybe he gets his opening stint and you kind of match minutes from there, they're going to need Grant to make an impact. And it hasn't really been there on either end of the floor. On offense, again, Golden State switching has taken away a lot of the gaps. And just their general help took away the paint. And so you don't get the clean drives. You don't get the rotations. And if you're not getting those, you're not getting the clean look from the corner that Grant Williams has feasted on throughout this season and this postseason in particular. So that hurts. And if you're not getting, you know, again, they mixed in like some traps or some show and recovers against Jason Tatum. But generally, like, you're not getting a steady dose of that. So you're not even getting Grant Williams on 4-on-3s or anything like that. And so it's just like, okay, what exactly are you there for? And if he's screening for someone, they're mostly just switching that too. And they're not dumping to him on the block. So you're not getting that. Defensively is where I'm just like, yo, you kind of have to bring. Because where Rob Williams is in a drop and he's trying to navigate some stuff. And again, they switched him a little bit more in game two. Grant Williams is your switch option at the bench. He should be your guy. He should be your change of pace guy behind Rob, where it's like, okay, if you're trying to run this fancy off-ball stuff for Steph, or you're running for Clay, or you're running for Jordan Poole, Grant Williams will be able to snuff that out and at the very least funnel you somewhere if you try to drive past him. First quarter game one, Steph drills a pull-up in Grant Williams. I was like, okay, he's not scared of Grant. That doesn't mean Grant can't do a good job or won't do a good job moving forward, but mindset, Steph doesn't care about Grant. Game two, much of the same. We saw a lot of switching from Grant Williams. He took away an initial gap, and then it's a drive, or it's a pull-up, or it's a drive, then a kick. If Grant Williams can't be a legit deterrent, that's really going to be a problem. Rob is already compromised, and it's a tough match. The Daniel Tice minutes. How have you felt about the Daniel Tice minutes?
Better than you have.
I see. Okay, fair enough. But the Daniel Tice minutes can be at least something for Golden State to pick at, because you know what his coverage is going to be. Grant kind of has to be. He has to be a bridge.
Well, I mentioned before the series started, how much of it is this going to be his type of series? His defensive strengths aren't necessarily as compatible with the star player as they have been in the series before this. It's tough to be as physical with someone like Stephen Curry. And even if you succeed initially, it's a drive, a kick, and now you have to chase him. And then you switch anyway. So then, you know what I mean? And so he's going to have to knock down shots or beat closeouts and then impact the other end, other game of the floor, other, the game of the, ugh, the game on the other end of the floor.
There
we're
go.
Getting there. We're getting
we
there.
We got there. Landed the plane.
Please, my goodness. I think he can have an impact. Boston needs him to, as you stated. I thought some of the tough part, I think a lot of people are going to talk about Horford, Smart, White. The bench wasn't as good as it needed to be. You know, they kind of poked holes. And we talked about the importance of the lineups in this series. Boston needs to have cards in the deck to throw at Golden State. And, you know, if Grant Williams is switching to Steph Curry and that's a dribble drive and attack and you have to help, that's not ideal. If Jordan Poole and Steph Curry see Peyton Pritchard and just immediately decide, hey, it's time to go to work. That's not ideal. If Tyson's on the floor and they're just like, we're going to pull up from wherever on the court. I mean, they ragged on poor Daniel Tice for being in a drop because Steph Curry took one dribble pass half court and threw it up at was cash. So I was like, what did you want the man to, like, that's greatness. What?
Daniel Tice was at a drop that his heel was on the 3-point line. I was like, bro, this is not what drop coverage was steamed up to be when this was created. That's not how that's.
Roy Hibbert would have still been in the paint. Y'all mad at Daniel? Anyways. They're going to need the impact players to lead the way, but they're going to need to find impact for their other guys. And again, just like we talked about after game one, it could just be a do it better type deal for Boston. Which leads me to my, how did you feel about Steph Curry as a whole in that game?
This feels like a trap, but I enjoyed Steph in this game. What's the face for? What did I do?
This man, he's just neutralized. He's not just neutralized Big Agenda. He just won't answer questions anymore. Like, I come up with just these valid questions and just pause.
Look, man, after the burger question in the watch party, like, I am just always on edge. You can ask me how I'm doing. I'm like, wait, let me check this timeline to make sure no one's asked. But no, like, I enjoyed the Steph game. Like, it was a nice mix of the drives, of the off-ball movement. And, you know, I'm not going to hammer it too much, but, like, Steph is a pick-and-roll ball handler, tends to generate some good stuff. And so it was interesting to see Golden State go more to that well, at least the percentage of their offense coming through pick and roll raised a little bit in game two from game one. Like, they cut their off-ball actions, second spectrum tracks, like off-ball screen stuff. They lost 79 off-ball screens in game one. They lost 38 game two. And the pick and roll number basically stayed static then for those two games. And so Steph just annihilated whatever cover he's off. It was switch, he was able to drive. If it was drop, he was able to pull up. And Boston has to find answers for that. And also, just a quick, while we're on the pick and roll front, just a quick shout out to Jordan Poole, who brought it in game two, particularly in that third quarter. They need him. They need him to produce. They need someone aside from Steph to be able to create against this Boston defense. And one of the problems for game one was it was Steph, but Poole didn't really show up. Clay missed a lot of shots. Andrew Wiggins scored, but he didn't, like, break Boston's defense in a way. Like, it was scoring that was very much one-on-one / okay, you can live with it type. You can't have all three of those things working at the same time, no matter how good Steph is. Game two, you got a little bit more of a mix. You had Jordan Poole step up. And as you mentioned, like, they set the tone a little bit early with trying to test out Robert Williams with Andrew Wiggins. So once you got that kind of blend, the offense flows a little more freely. And so that's good stuff from Golden State. I guess just to zoom back out to your question, I really enjoyed Steph's game.
Well, I'm going to ask you two questions when it comes to Steph.
All right.
Number one, how did you feel the contrast of their pick and roll heavy attack, quote unquote, as opposed to the struggles maybe in pick and roll in the fourth quarter of game one? Did you feel anything different? Did it make you feel differently?
I feel like, and I guess just eyeball, like, it felt like there was a little bit more of a tempo in game two than there was in game one. Because game one, at least in that fourth quarter, it was like, all right, let's walk it up or jog it up, and we're just going to find Robert Williams. We're going to try to find this pressure and see if we can get something going to kind of quell this run. And Boston was able to just kind of key in. And in game two, it was, all right, we're going to start with this handoff. We're going to do some off-ball stuff, and then, hey, pick and roll. Oh, it worked, pick and roll. All right, let's go off-ball again. All right, here's some more pick and roll. And, like, even with that, a lot of the actions felt like they were coming a little bit earlier in the clock.
I'm going to circle back to that blend point you just made, as long as I don't forget. But I'm going to ask another question with Steph Curry. How much, or what did you feel like was more impactful? That simplifying the game for Golden State, or maybe getting Marcus Smart having to navigate more and more?
That's a good question. I think moving smart around helps, particularly when Derek White isn't in the game. Like, I think that's important for things important to kind of make him work. I think if you're able to tire him out at all, then that is going to make the decision-making a little bit worse on offense. Tired, the decision is going to be a little bit sloppier. The pass is going to be a little bit sloppier. And again, he's very important to what Boston wants to do offensively. If they get him going, that allows Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown and even Al Horford to attack some closeouts, or they just get more openings if you're able to bend the defense that way. If Smart isn't doing that, then it's almost all offense. It's almost all defense at that point, which, again, he's a good defender, but you saw him on Steph chasing him around. You saw him on Klay Thompson sometimes. You saw him on Draymond Green. And, like, there was a post-up from Draymond Green that ended up with a Marcus Smart deflection. He ended up poking the ball away and knocking the ball out of bounds. But, like, even with that, it's like, okay, they're really going to get Marcus. The Draymond post-ups, there are only a handful of them. And, like, they weren't all, like, scoring opportunities. They were a lot of dump-ins for, like, the post-split stuff. But it was interesting to see him like mix in some, hey, wait a minute, you are smaller than me, Derek. Let me at least get some body blows in. And kind of circling back out to the Peyton Pritchard point, I guess just bookmark the Klay Thompson post up on Peyton Pritchard. Because that could be a way to get Klay going if they're on the floor at the same time. Because Klay just has not had it through the first two games. That could be a way to get him going. And also, if Golden State just has the kind of mindset like, hey, we can run our offense and try to get at Peyton Pritchard a little bit. And also, if all else fails, we can just simplify and just get it to our big wing. We can give it to Jordan Poole and say, hey, go to work against Peyton. Instead of just being able to set up the blend, I guess, before it comes. I think that's going to be important to monitor.
Well, yeah, I think we've spoken about it. The blend for Golden State is very important. They have to hit the right notes. I think kind of flipping it a little bit as far as the pick and roll goes, I think it set a tone. I think there's a lot more decisiveness with that. And even just starting with that with pace or starting something and going to that just kind of kept the defense off balance. And it felt like more of a, this isn't how we're going to score particularly. It's okay, this is what we're doing to start our possession. And if the play is there, we can make it. If not, we can play out of that. And now we mix in the off-ball actions as opposed to maybe the other way around. So now it has more impact. If it's just a swing, now you think a screen's coming. Now it's a quick drive or it's a fake dribble handoff. Or now here comes a post-up. You got to deal with that. So I thought that was good. How Boston reacts and if they can get Golden State back into the mud is going to be interesting. Because while Golden State did what they were supposed to do, they'll still struggle. It's still a fight. So for Boston, it's probably just being more consistent, more locked in. They'll probably be more prepared. And we'll see how they react, what they decide to do to react. Is it more switching? Is it more just trying to live with the one-on-one play and try and get them back in the mud that way? You know, it's a fun feeling out process, basketball-wise, between these two teams, trying to find what's going to get them this championship. And the fun of it is, it's a sprint. So they only got to do it three more times.
This is true. Like I like where the series is already, where I think either team can make the case like, hey, if we just do this thing a little bit better, we're up 2-0. Like for Golden State, like, hey, if we don't fall apart in the fourth quarter of game one, we're up 2-0. And Boston's like, hey, we were down 2 in the first half of game 2 while throwing up all over ourselves for a large chunk of it. If we just tighten up and don't get rattled with some of the hashtag antics early on, like we probably could put together something in the second half. And maybe we're 2-0 going to Boston. And I think both teams in this series have been able to poke at something, which also makes it fun. We've also seen some counters in games too. So I'm amped for the rest of this series. Like this is the good stuff.
It's the good stuff. We've seen both teams have success without necessarily being able to say, hey, there's this one thing that the other team just can't do this series. That's a good place to be at in the championship series. I find that fun.
That it is. All right, before we close this thing out, let's get into some general NBA news. Quinn Snyder is no longer the head coach of the Utah Jazz. Was that a surprising news break for you?
It was surprising how and when it did. I wasn't necessarily anticipating that notification. We'll get the joke off real quick. They asked that man red pill or blue pill, and he said, "Nah, I'm good." But I mean, I thought, one, hope everything's well with him. Two, it felt like, I think he was sincere when he said, maybe not they need another voice, but what else was he supposed to do with this team in this 8-year run? You look at how, like, a hell of a run, by the way.
Yes.
How much this Utah team has evolved from when he started. Right, this was a defense, gutsy, half-court type team that evolved into different things as they went on. Like, is Joe Johnson a jazz legend?
Oh, boy.
But, oh, you know, boy. you had different versions of this squad, and they went from that defense to the offensive juggernaut they were, I guess, with 2 seasons ago now. And where else do you go? Like, I feel like not just with him, not just with Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, I think everyone could probably sit down and be like, you know what? We did what we came to do, and I don't know what else we can go with this. Mm-hmm. And that's a part of life, folks. It's not always necessarily a sad or bad thing. You put the work in, you have the success, and sometimes it's time to just move on.
That seems to be where Snyder and the Jazz are. Like, I could see him just kind of seeing the writing on the wall, at least with this exit, where it's like, okay, the big move is going to be Gobert ship somewhere, or Donovan Mitchell presses the big red button. Which, as a brief aside,
and honestly, both could happen.
And both could happen. I was just about to say, as an aside, like, there's been so much smoke around Mitchell's future in Utah over the last year and a half anyway. It was a little bit interesting to get the Woj tweet where it's like, oh, now he's unnerved and unsure about what's happening. I'm just like,
what you mean? I'm not even talking about Donovan Mitchell, the person. But the concept, this is an out.
That's, yeah.
I can say it out loud now.
Yeah.
You gave me a reason. Well, yeah, I don't even know how he feels, but hey, no, I can quickly throw this out here. And now it's out there, and I have a reason. So, what's up?
Yep, that's where I was going. I was like, that's a very convenient, a reasonable feeling, obviously. In that Woj report, he says, like, Quinn Snyder was a big reason why Mitchell was okay committing. But also, Quinn Snyder was a big reason why he was committed long-term to this Utah team. Like, he loves playing for him. And was listening to the Low Post earlier today with Tim McMahon. Big Man said, like, the relationship between Mitchell and Snyder still seems to be strong. Like, there wasn't any blow up or anything like that on that front. And so it's perfectly understandable if Mitchell's like, hey, wait a minute. Quinn ain't back after this, with this run and with this ending. Like, Quinn's the one that's gone first. That's odd. And so I'm just curious about where this is going to go. As you mentioned, like, this could be the out if Donovan Mitchell wants. And I think it's fair to have those other conversations once we find out if Mitchell wants it or if he doesn't. Until then, it's just odd. And I am intrigued by what Utah has to do with this roster. And to the timing point, you already hit on it. Like, Snyder making this decision now when Mike D'Antoni and Kenny Atkinson are having, like, the final meetings with Michael Jordan in Charlotte. Darvin Ham, we didn't even touch on Darvin Ham being hired by the Lakers, but Darvin Ham now having his introductory press conference earlier today, again, recording on Monday. Now Quinn's out. That timing has to stink for Utah at the very least.
Stats. Anyways.
Here we go.
I think it's very interesting, the coaching leaks and the cycle through the coaching candidates and how it's reported, and this name is here and then Kenny Atkinson's gonna do the final meeting, but just wait, so's Mike D'Antoni. And it was like, you know, that was one of the first names that was mentioned. It's very interesting. He now comes back into play. Seems very similar to a Kingly situation where, you know, anyways. It's not the pod for that. We got different tier for that content.
There we go. The dunker spot patron.
I am not in the Illuminati yet.
Yeah, we're not going to ignore that yet. That's fine. Anyway, while we're on the Western Conference and teams that had high hopes that bowed out before the conference finals, there is some more smoke surrounding the Phoenix Suns and the DeAndre Ayton business. It was odd that he was not maxed before the year. And now, according to John Hollinger and The Athletic, there's a piece he did with James Edwards of The Athletic, Pistons beat writer, where the bomb is kind of dropped, or semi-bomb, I suppose, to where sources told The Athletic that it is more likely than not that DeAndre Ayton will be playing elsewhere next. I'm trying to figure out, like, how I feel about this. Because on one hand, like, it's kind of shameful that the Suns just didn't pay him. Like, he earned the contract based on last season, but particularly the second half of the season and the postseason. Like, pay your number one pick that is producing and is a big part of what you want to do. Open. On the other end, I do think to the rumblings that we've heard and some of the interactions that we've seen throughout this year between Ayton and Monty Williams. And as someone that's, like, followed the Heat very closely throughout, like, my life period, but, like, throughout recent NBA lore and whatnot, my eyebrow does perk up when a high-level coach has a talented center, and on paper it makes sense, and on court it makes some sense, but the very talented high-level head coach is like, actually, I think I'm okay with these guys that are less talented. And so the end-of-season presser the end of game seven, where Monty's asked about, like, hey, where did Ayton go? Like, what happened? And it's internal. That wasn't a, man, we had a tough moment. We talked it out. I'm ready to see what he's going to do this offseason. I believe in yada, yada. That was just, it's internal. That's it. Huh. This is interesting. And so, like, I trust Monty enough. And we saw what Phoenix was able to do during the regular season, again, postseason. But we saw what happened when Ayton went down and JaVale McGee and later Bismack Biyombo stepped in. Like, wait, the pick and roll is still kind of humming. This is interesting. Wait, JaVale in the drop is still fine. It's not Ayton, but it's solid. Bismack Biyombo is showing to the level of screens and he's trapping sometimes. Like, it's not Ayton, but it's solid. And so if you can patch that together enough in light of Cam Johnson being extension eligible this summer as well, I find myself being less upset at the prospect of Ayton not being there, if that makes sense. But I get that more from, like, Monty's side, because I do think this ultimately stems from, like, I just don't think Robert Sarver wanted to shell out the money. And he already sees, like, the Paul contract is this, Booker contract is this, we just paid Mikal, Cam Johnson's getting paid too. I don't want to pay for Ayton. I think that's where it stemmed from, and I can't excuse that. But the actual on-court product, I can see where Monty's at, because I saw it with Spo and Hassan Whiteside. And I saw what happened when I saw, like, Willie Reedman that were okay. And, like, I just, that's, my brows just kind of raised on that situation, if that makes sense.
So do you understand, like, maybe DeAndre Ayton's perspective?
Oh, yeah, I definitely get it from Ayton's side as well.
I don't think the hashtag is Big Agenda, Kendrick Perkins.
Of course.
I don't blame DeAndre Ayton for actually getting into it with Monty Williams. You got to get that big fella paid.
Oh, man. That's good stuff, man. I can't even hate. That's good stuff. That is good stuff.
You see, the thing is, defense is going to think they know what play is coming. That's why you continue to build and run your counters. You show it early, then you run a counter, then you bring it right back later after a timeout.
That's incredible. That is What are your Aiden thoughts when we get out of here? That's amazing.
That was my Aiden thought for now. Come on. You got to know when to end. Yeah. Got to know when to hold them, when to fold them.
All right, that's my cue. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Join the Dunker Spot community if you have not already on Twitter. If you have that app accessibility, do so. Search Dunker Spot. Get in there. We're hosting watch parties, having fun conversations in there. There are even more jokes and banter in the chat. I have been Photoshopped in like 37 different ways at this point. Whatever. The fun stuff's happening in the community, so do that. You can find me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later.
Nikias really said, I improved this show like Russell Westbrook helps his teammates.